Hi, my name is Valerie Downing. I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is October 13th, 1992, so you can listen to about 13 minutes of what I have to say. The rest is crap. And very honored to be here. My home group is the Jaywalkers group, and we meet on Tuesday nights. We've got a speaker meeting. And on Friday nights, we've got a beginner's meeting. We take a break, and then we've got a closed discussion meeting. So if you're in Richmond, come see us. I really enjoyed Joe's. An amazing talk. I don't feel like I have too much to add to what he said. And I'm very shaky, so excuse me if I like jitter that way. Part of it's just nerves, and then part of it's just some other stuff that's going on. But anyway, just to tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened. I was a lot like Joe, very separated from everyone ever since I can remember. Very afraid, very, I may have to sit down. Can I sit down? Okay. I've got a little thyroid problem happening, so
sure.
I get, my muscles kind of go crazy. Forgive me. I thought I'd be all better, but evidently not. Anyway, so sorry about that.
Cool.
So grew up feeling very, very separated from everyone. I came from an alcoholic family, and I thought that the reason that I was having so many... Okay, touch me there. Yes. A little off the wall. Thank you. I can get away with that. Because I'm really just kidding. Years ago, I wouldn't have been kidding. But anyway. I grew up in an alcoholic home. It was very insane. Lots of violence. Lots of drinking. And my father bringing strange women home. It was very entertaining. I felt very separate from everybody. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. As far back as I can remember, just very afraid of people. And I always felt very inappropriate. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. Or if I did do something or if I did say something, it always seemed to be the wrong thing. I, like Joe, was a huge thief ever since I was a little girl. And I also stole toys from the neighbor and hid them under my bed. My sponsor in... sobriety this time talked to me about being power seekers and being a power seeker. And I understand that because that's what I've been looking for all my life. And I think when I was younger, that's a lot of what I never had enough. Nothing was ever okay. And I was always looking for something and always looking outside of myself for something to fill that hole in my gut, that huge hole, that uncomfortability. That restlessness, that irritability, and absolutely discontented with everything and everybody. And that's one of the first places I found power was in stealing. Found a lot of power there. And I did that for a very long time, and it was years into sobriety this time that I was even willing to surrender that and let that go. And thank God that's been removed. So grew up just funky. I moved around a lot. My mom and dad got divorced. She married a pilot in the Navy. We moved around a lot with that. I did not respond well to authority figures. And there was a lot of discipline in my house once my mother married my stepfather. And I didn't do really well with that. I didn't like adults. I didn't trust adults. I didn't like or trust anybody, really. Because I just felt so separate from everybody. And I always felt mistreated, too, that people just didn't understand me or what was happening with me. Very lonely. I had my first drink when I was around 14, 15 years old, and I wasn't drinking very long. But what happened to me was such magic when I drank, even though I experienced consequences as a result of my drinking. It was such magic that I just pursued that at the expense of everything. Up to that point, I was... a pretty good student, was trying to do things. Once I started drinking, everything went to the side. Within a period of a year, my parents started sending me to psychologists and psychiatrists trying to figure out what was wrong with me. I was labeled an ungovernable by the state of Florida, habitual runaway, habitual truant, in juvenile detention centers, juvenile transient youth centers, just all of that. And it was all as a result of my drinking and how I began to live once I started to drink, because I pursued it no matter what the consequences were. I didn't care what the consequences were, because I finally had some peace when I drank. I finally felt like I fit when I drank. So I didn't really care about all of that. And absolutely, I thought it was everybody else's fault anyway. I mean, I thought it was my parents' fault. I wasn't nurtured correctly. It was because of, you know, my alcoholic father, my mean stepfather, my unavailable mother, because of my rotten little brothers. I mean, just the list went on and on. I just wasn't nurtured. I mean, I loved it when I got to go into therapy and start looking at my inner child. I mean, I was in heaven. Because, you know, it was seriously damaged and wounded, and I wanted to heal it. And I bought into all of that. And I really thought that a lot of that was why I was an alcoholic. That's why I was having problems. And I didn't know that the reason I was alcoholic was that I was just physically and mentally different from other people. I do not process alcohol in the same way as non-alcoholics. And it doesn't do for non-alcoholics what it does for me. It, like Joe beautifully explained, something happens when I drink where things that are insane start to make sense, seem like a great idea. And just that freedom from myself. And that freedom from the fear. And I'll pay that price. And paid the price. So I lived that way for a while. And then one of the shrinks that my parents were sending me to told my parents that I had a drug and alcohol problem. And they better put me in a treatment center. So I went into a treatment center at 15 in 1982. I was in there for 3 months. And it was great. It was a great vacation from everything. I loved it. I was very angry when I first got there, but then I loved it because it was no responsibility. And responsibility at that point was beginning to become inconvenient. I didn't like going to school. I didn't like doing what I had been asked to do or any of that stuff. I was, you know, all of that stuff was a pain. So it was a nice vacation from that. I used to love to try to make myself sick, too, so I could put myself in the hospital to get a vacation. Loved it. And all the attention. Just really sick. Anyway, but the great thing that happened to me, though, when I was there was that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember our counselor there, Dick Tibbetts, he was a member of AA, and him telling us that only 1 out of 10 of us would make it. And I remember thinking that I was going to be one of those people. I was not, however, voted as most likely to succeed in treatment. You know, when I was in treatment, they had levels, and if you were good and doing what you were supposed to do, you got to move up levels and you got more privileges and stuff like that. And I wasn't good in treatment. I had drugs snuck out to get beer, sneaking over the boy side, and I got into trouble all the time. And I left on level one, day one, after being there. So I didn't follow the rules very well. But I remember thinking, I'm going to be one of the people that makes it, because, you know, I want to be the best. And I want the attention and all of that stuff. So, so anyway, I got out and I started going to AA meetings. I was really uncomfortable because my mom was dropping me off at AA. And there's nothing worse than that, having your mommy drop you off at AA. When I went there at that time in Florida, in Jacksonville, there were not a lot of young people in AA at all. And some of the guys, the old crusty guys that were there, would tell me, you know, you're really young. You can stop. You just need to go home, go to church, do what your parents are telling you. You don't have to do what we've done. And what I heard was, I'm not an alcoholic. And I didn't want to be one anyway, but I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I had to go. So, but then it became my personal mission to prove to the crusties that's what I called them, the crusties, to prove to them that I was an alcoholic. So I started showing up at the meetings drunk. I stole their key to the clubhouse, and I stole their money, and that's where I take my friends to go drink, was at the AA clubhouse. And was just not a stellar member of AA. But I would always run back to AA when I got into trouble, and I continued to get into trouble all over the place, getting caught stealing. I'd start drinking again, steal cars, just running with a crazy crowd, sneaking into bars. I mean, just all that stuff. And I'd just get into some kind of trouble, and I'd run back to AA. I'd get sober, you know, 2 or 3 months. At one point, I made an attempt to get a sponsor and do what she asked me to do. I vaguely remember doing some step work with her. I remember she made me box up all my stuff and send it back, all the stuff I'd stolen, which was, I didn't give it all up, but I gave up a lot. But she asked, did you give it all up? And I was like, oh, yeah. You know, I mean, just still very unwilling to surrender. And I'm not going to give up everything. And I don't think I, at that point when I look back at it, that I even really understood what it was to be an alcoholic and what that meant, how doomed I really was. I was there out of parental pressure. And so I didn't get into more legal trouble. Because my choice was you get sober or you go to a juvenile detention center. So anyway, but in and out of AA for a couple of years. And when I was 17, I got into a lot of legal trouble from stealing. And at that point, I made this decision that I was going to get sober and stay sober for the rest of my life. And I meant that. And my father was now sober in California, in L.A., and he was sober about 5 years, and I called him up because, you know, I like to move around because things get heavy and people don't like you anymore. I mean, I was famous for moving from group to people, from group to group to group to group, and never really fitting in any one group. I never, Allison is probably the longest, and she is the longest friend I've ever had, ever. I never stayed friends with anybody for very long because I damaged the relationship so badly because my behavior became so erratic and irrational and psychopathic. And so, I mean, I just did a lot of damage to people. And I didn't mean to do that. Just something happened to me when I started drinking. And then if I went too long without drinking, I started to get a little crazy and started to do some crazy crap. So anyway, I got a friend of mine in California calls it sobriety. I was sober, but I was dry. So sobriety, it wasn't sobriety. So I conned my father into letting me come out to California with him. And he said, you can come out here, but you got to work the steps first. And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So my solution to that was to get the 12 and 12 and read that. And I call him weekly with my step updates. And I just basically read what was in there and then try to talk to him about it like I had taken a step. I didn't have a sponsor at that point. I didn't do any of that stuff. I was just trying to get out of Florida and to California where it was going to be different. And where I'd be with my father, who is now in AA, and he would understand me and he would understand the hateful things that had happened to me as a result of him leaving me with my stepfather and my mother. He was going to fix it. And I had dropped out of school, and it was just crazy. My parents, my mom and dad, could not wait to get me out of the house because of the turmoil I was causing there. So I went out there. I conned my way out there. He told me later, he goes, I knew the second you got off the plane that nothing had changed by looking at you. And I understand what he's talking about today because we see it in AA today. Something happens to people who have taken the steps and recovered. To people who have woken up spiritually, they look different. They act different. They talk different. They carry themselves differently. Something's happened to them. So I understand what he's talking about. At that point, though, I didn't. He owed me a lot of money because he pilfered my trust fund. So I took that money and ran. I didn't work. I was crazy in AA. I went to a meeting every day. I had a sponsor, a name only, and the only reason I got that sponsor is so my father could continue to give me money. Because that was the little thing. I'll give you this check, but you need to have a sponsor. And I'm like, okay. So I had a sponsor, name only, and he picked her for me, and that was fine, whatever. And I went to a meeting every day. We hung out at the 502 Club in Covina, California. This guy, Big Book Mac, who was there, he told me to sit down, shut up, keep my legs crossed, because my version of helping others was chasing the boys and seeing how many I could land. And, I mean, just being a real female predator in AA and preying on other people in order to solve my problem and to solve the uncomfortability within me. Because I was stark raving sober. I was still a thief, still a liar, and going to a meeting every day. Going to the 13-step dances, hanging out. I was not hanging with the winners of AA. As a matter of fact, at the club that we used to hang out at, it was called the 502 Club, and it was all about who's on who at the 502. That's what we talked about. And so, you know, I didn't stick with the winners in AA. I wasn't really, I didn't run with those people. Those people made me uncomfortable. And, you know, I hung around with the boys and went to a meeting every day, and sick stuff was coming out of my mouth. I was not recovered at all. When I look back at my sobriety then and what it is today, it's completely different. I had no clue about what was going on. What I thought was going on was not what was going on, which is, you know, the story of my life. Anyway, so that lasted about 3.5 years, and I drank again. I met this man who wanted to save me, and I thought I'd let him do that because he had some money, and of course that will take care of it. And he called me his diamond in the rough, and he had no idea what he was getting into at all. I've had a lot of amends that I've had to make to him. As a matter of fact, when I went back to make amends to him this time, because we ended up getting married and all this stuff, he said, you know, those 4 years I spent with you were the worst 4 years of my life. I mean, that's not high praise, you know. That's not a good letter of recommendation. So anyway, I mean, I just ripped and roared through people's lives, and I had no idea. I was so consumed with myself. I was so turned inward and so self-centered. I had no idea. I had not a clue. You know, we were talking before this meeting, you know, I used to not like emotions, and then I want to feel my emotions. But the thing that scared me the most is when I felt nothing. Absolutely nothing. Felt dead. And I felt that way drinking, and I felt that way in sobriety, and can be a scary place. Because, you know, I like to live on the edge, you know. Like things that go boom. Give me high drama. Whether it's, you know, incredible excitement or down in the dumps, I want to kill myself and die stuff. I mean, whatever. I like that stuff. I don't like the ordinary very much. And I've had to learn about that, a lot about that in the spiritual life, too. I like things that go boom in my relationship with God. And if it isn't going boom, then, you know, I think I'm doing something wrong or God isn't present. And I found out that that's just not true. But anyway, so I drank again. It happened just like that. There was no effective mental defense against the first drink, like our literature talks about. And the reason was is because nothing had changed with me. I had not had that psychic change. I was still very, very sick, just not drinking. As a matter of fact, I really believe I got sicker not drinking. In a way, I think my alcoholism was progressing, even though I was not drinking, because I was becoming very, very spiritually ill and mentally ill as well. I understand what they're talking about with grave emotional and mental disorders, because if I haven't recovered, I lead a really ugly life. Even though I'm not drinking, if I'm not trying to live by spiritual principles, I just do really ugly things. Psychopathic, you know, with no conscience whatsoever, with no remorse. And that is still with me today sometimes, and that blows my mind. But on the whole, AA has given me a conscience and a God of my understanding, where there was nothing for a very long time. I could do a lot of things and just feel nothing. But I think something was going on, because I would end up in a lot of depressions, and I really think a lot of that was because of how I lived. You know, I used to think you could go out and do whatever you wanted to do and there was no price to pay. And through sponsorship, I have learned that, you know, no matter what you do, there's a price to pay with everything. And I want to go live the way I want to live, and when I'm not living by spiritual principles, I want to live that way, lying, stealing, cheating, harming others, and expect not to pay a price. And there's a price to pay for all of that. You know, and for a long time I thought the answer to that was medication. Let me take some medication. That'll take the edge off. You know, that'll relieve the depression. When the root of my depression was how I was living. I was just not very well. And as a result of doing AA and doing what AA asked me to do, very rarely do I get depressed. And my sponsor gave me a great prayer for that. He said, God help me not to get depressed about being depressed. You know, when it shows up, because sometimes it still shows up. But, you know, I like to get wrapped around that stuff. And I like to put my little emotions on an altar and worship them, you know. Hold on to those and for everything they're worth. And I love to do that with depression. So, but I rarely get depressed today, which is nice. And I never thought that I'd get there, because I used to get into just down on the floor suicidal depressions and have tried to take my life several times as a result of that stuff. Anyway, so I went back out, and I went out for about 4 years and moved to Atlanta for a couple years, got involved in the music industry because I wanted to hang around with important people. And I wanted to be important by association, and failed miserably because I was drinking and just driven very much by fear and just a lot of destruction. I really struggled with for a while with my drinking, trying to control my drinking. There were a lot of things that I tried to do to control it. I tried having a son. I thought that getting pregnant would solve the problem. I also thought raising sheep would solve my problem. when we moved outside of Atlanta and we bought 20 acres, and I don't know where I got that idea, but pretty soon I was drunk with my sheep. And never shear sheep drunk. It's a bad thing. And more so for the sheep. And you know, and I say this, and it's very true. Well, I'm not going to say it. Well, I will say it. It's a good thing I wasn't a man with those sheep drunk. Because I would have had carnal knowledge of those sheep. I understand sexual dysfunction, you know. I can see how it happens. So anyway, but just drunk with the sheep and talking to my sheep drunk. And I mean, it wasn't good, you know. I did, for the most part, once I got pregnant, stop drinking. But even that I couldn't do completely. Once I had my son, I was trying to be a good parent. And because I really thought that that would solve my problem. I mean, just really juvenile, immature thinking. Really warped thinking. Of if I have a child, you know, everything's going to be okay. And I'll have something to love. And it will love me unconditionally. And you know, just crazy thinking, very juvenile thinking. I had no idea about the responsibility of having a child. Once I had my son, I had no idea what I was in for. There were several times I said to my husband at the time, I can't handle this. I don't want this. Can we please give this thing away? I just couldn't handle it. I didn't know what to do with it. And I wanted to be a good mother. My intention was to be a good mother. My intention was to be a good wife. My intention was to straighten up and fly right, and I just couldn't do it. I tried to do it, and I couldn't do it. And the doctor, I was breastfeeding at the time, and I went to the doctor, and they said, you know, if you drink beer, and I wasn't a beer drinker. I always drank liquor. I thought beer was for wimps, and I just didn't like the taste either, but I thought you were a wuss if you drank beer. I was just a straight liquor drinker. Anyway, my doctor at the time said, if you will drink some beer, it'll help let your milk down, whatever. And I said, okay, and I started drinking beer, and that's what set me off, and I was gone. My alcoholism really progressed in my last 2 years of drinking. I became a daily drinker. I led a very, very ugly life. I did all the things that I swore I would never, ever do. I went places that I thought I'd never go. I really led the double life. I was hanging out in biker bars at night and trying to be a fine art rep during the day. I mean, it was insane. I wasn't a good wife. I didn't know how to be a wife. I was not a good mother. I'd drop my son off and not come back. I'd drive with him drunk in the car. I mean, on and on the stuff that we do. And still a liar, still a thief. Still expecting my circumstances. If my circumstances would change, if you would change, then I would be okay. Just really damaging. So I was not pleasant to live with too. I was a very violent person for a very long time, and I carried that into sobriety for a while. I mean, I just go after you physically. I just didn't care. I started carrying a gun for a little while. I mean, just insane thinking and behavior. Trying to be something. I don't know what, but trying to be something. And my bottom, I don't know why it happened. It was a drunken evening, just like everything else, every night up to that point. But for some reason, my father called me that night, and he, in essence, 12 sent me back into AA, and I was drunk. I was just insane. But I had a moment of clarity when he was talking to me. I really believe that the God under my understanding touched me. And I made this decision. Well, we were getting ready to move to Richmond, Virginia. And I said, well, when I move to Richmond, I'm going to get sober. And I'm going to be done with all this. And because the consequences were getting pretty high there, too. So I was glad we were moving as well. Because, you know, about 2 years is all it takes. And it's time to go. Anyway, so I get down here to Richmond and I go to a meeting. But you know, when I was in New York, it's like, oh, when I move to Richmond, I'm going to get sober, but I'm going to get good and drunk now, you know. So my last couple months up there, I was crazy, ripping and roaring, drunk every night, just crazy, living just a crazy life. I mean, it was really ugly. And I'm glad that my now ex-husband wasn't up there to see that, what I was doing. It never occurred to me that when that me making that decision that I wouldn't be able to not stop drinking, because I had made the decision to go back to AA before and would stop drinking for a while. And it never occurred to me that I couldn't do that. I think my alcoholism had just progressed. And I got down to Richmond and went to a meeting and was serious about sobriety. I felt like I was home. I knew that was where I was supposed to be. I got a sponsor immediately that night. She ended up being committed shortly after, but she was perfect for me for those first 3 weeks or so. We understood each other. She understood me. I understood her. But anyway, serious about sobriety. Wanted to be there. Wanted to be there. Got a sponsor immediately. Was willing to do whatever you guys asked me to do. And I ended up drinking two more times, and I did not want to drink. Did not want to. And I'm grateful for that experience because it helped me really identify. I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I've lost the power to choose whether I'm going to drink or not. That I can have great need, great wish, great knowledge of myself as an alcoholic, and I shouldn't drink, and it's not enough. There really has to be a power greater than myself that I'm surrendered to. And my last drink was up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went up there to see an artist, and he had bourbon in his studio. Or some kind of whiskey, I don't know. I think it was a bourbon. And he asked me if I wanted a shot. I said, yeah. And I didn't want to do that. That's not why I went to go see him. That's not what I intended to happen. And then I only got two shots in. And then my husband shows up to pick me up. And that's the worst thing in the world, to have it ruined. You know, where you get stopped. You know, because you're just starting to feel a little warm and good in there. And and that got interrupted, and so later on that night, I was trying to finish the job, and I just got on my knees and asked God to help me. And since then, I haven't had a drink. It hasn't been necessary for me to drink. But also, I've had to become, I was willing when I got here, not become willing to do what you guys asked me to do, what AA asked me to do. So I got another sponsor, because my other one was in the loony bin, and called her every day, went to a meeting every day, got a home group, and was just really on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me no major decisions in the first year. I didn't listen to that, but I immediately started having other relationships because my husband wasn't enough. And and ended up leaving him. You know, my sponsor said, just sit still, go to meetings, you know. And I was crazy. I stopped drinking. I was crazy. I was bouncing off the walls, insane. Couldn't work. I started cleaning. I left my husband. I had no idea about how to live in the world. I had no idea about being self-supporting through my own contributions in any kind of way, financially, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. I not a clue on how to live. No idea. Didn't know how to do a checkbook, nothing. Because I'd always been taken care of or found somebody to take care of me. So I had no idea how to live. So my first year was pretty nuts. And then I got this home group that Allison was talking about. And it was called the Fourth Dimension Group. And I started going to that meeting. And they were reading out of the big book. And shit, I didn't even know how it worked came out of the big book. I had no clue. I just didn't know. And I'd had a big book since 1982. And I literally had glass stains on my big book. You know, the little round things, little white things. And I had no idea. I really didn't know. But it was awesome for me because I started to really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. I started to really identify with other people. They would read from that. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. That's what happened to me. And I had no idea that there were directions in the big book. It was phenomenal to me when there were directions on how to start and end your day. I mean, it was like, oh my God, it was like a little spiritual light bulbs just started going off in my life, you know? And, you know, I started praying regularly. I had that pink cloud experience. I was around 9 months sober when that happened for me. I just had that pink cloud and was just on fire, and I was going to save AA and save the world and save every female that walked in the doors. And I mean, I was just really got very, very just excited about Alcoholics Anonymous and excited about God, and started praying and feeling better and working better and having a better time and just all that stuff. My life was still really unmanageable. I was still very violent at times. I'm happy to report that I haven't had the cops call on me in sobriety in a very long time. That hasn't been necessary. But still stealing. But my life was getting better. And I really found some hope and started to identify in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I was still very, very sick. Just in every way that you can be. But people in AA were very loving towards me, and they kept telling me to come back. And, you know, and I started to just learn a lot and just having great experiences and started to work and just becoming self-supporting. When I was around 3.5 years sober, I don't have a watch. I forgot to grab one, so I can't see that. I don't have my glasses on. Thank you, honey. What time do I stop? Oh, okay, I see. I had to find her little thing. There it is. Okay. I found the thingy. So around 3.5 years sober, at the end of a relationship, I got, you know, in the dirt, and got really, really insane. People in AA were like, stay away from me because my behavior got really erratic. I became very, very angry and rageful, and then also suicidally depressed. Lost everything. No car, no job, no place to live, no money. And it was the worst time in my life, but it was also the greatest gift I was ever given. I got humbled and flattened in a way that hasn't happened since, and I hope it doesn't have to. I hope I don't. I'm not so close-minded and running through old ideas that I end up in that kind of situation again. I just got floored completely, and I hated the people in AA. Thought they were all full of crap. I was like, "Where's the love and kindness? Well, you're stealing from us, asshole. We don't like you anymore." You know? So. But you're supposed to love me anyway. Well, you're a liar. You're a cheater. You're insane. Stay away from us, you know. But but you're supposed to love me anyway, you know, anyway. But so, I mean, it was just crazy. I was crazy, crazy. I got, that relationship became my higher power. That's what I worshipped. That's what I pursued. It defined everything for me. All my dependency was on that. And I really think that I had to get stripped of everything to get my dependency on God. Because I tell you, if I can get it somewhere else, that's where I'll go. So I just got completely flattened and stripped of everything. And it was a really painful process, but it was really necessary. It took me 2 years to come out of that completely, and a lot of work. And it took me almost 2 years to come out of that depression completely. And it took a lot of work. I met this gal named Camille, and she didn't know me, so I figured that's why she didn't hate me. And but she lived in Louisville, Kentucky, and she just took one look at me, and she said, you know, you're a mad dog alcoholic, and you're going to die, you know, like one of those bad Louisiana psychics. And did y'all see Robin Williams? That's what he talked about. It was very funny. And that reminded me of Camille, because that's what she looked like and sounded like when she said that. And she said, you know, if you're willing, come on out here to Louisville, Kentucky, and I'll talk to you, and I'll take you through these steps, and we'll go from there. And I heard hope in her voice. The reason why was because I heard her talk at Alan Allison's conference, and they had asked me to host her. And I was lucky that they let me keep that commitment, too, because I was insane. And anyway, I loved her because she talked about being 12 years sober and being just completely crazy, dating this crazy guy and being at the door waiting for him to come in with a shotgun because she was going to blow the old boy away. And I mean, she got me right there because that's where I was at. I was, you know, hanging with a shotgun ready to blow people away and dying in AA. And thinking AA doesn't work anymore. I've done everything you've asked me to do. Why isn't it working? What's wrong? You know, I'm sponsoring people. I'm going to meetings. I'm working the steps, blah, blah, blah. Screw you. You know, I was very angry. But anyway, so she got a hold of me, and I'm really grateful for that because she really saved my life in AA. And I borrowed $40 because I didn't have a job, and I went to Louisville, Kentucky. And she just sat down, she talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were parts that I wasn't fully in, and she talked to me about the three legacies of AA, and we talked about the steps, and she talked to me about inventory, and there were some things that I left off my inventory that I hadn't put on there. There were also amends that I was unwilling to make that I would never make, and things like that. And she said, well, you haven't fully given yourself here. You haven't fully taken these steps. You haven't utterly abandoned yourself here to the best of your ability because you consciously held on to this stuff. She asked me to look at the traditions and my conduct in meetings and my relationship with AA. And when things are going great, I got a great relationship with AA. When things are not going so hot, I don't have a great relationship with AA. My relationship with AA is based on how I feel. And that was getting me into trouble. I'll go to my committed meetings when it's convenient. You know, if I'm not too tired. If I'm not, you know, holed up in my room, depressed, isolating, because I've had a bad day, then I'll go. I'll help. If I did a lot in helping other alcoholics, but I would cancel on you if I was having emotional upset. If my relationship was more important. If we just had a fight and I just couldn't make it, you know, we have to have our priorities here. You know, just stuff like that. I was not, and how I conducted myself in meetings, you know, showing up early, staying late, not getting up and down during meetings. I mean, just having manners, really, and learning and honoring our traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous. So didn't really have a strong relationship there. And in being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, again, it was the convenience thing. I'll be of service. I'll be your intergroup rep when it's convenient. So I'll be your GSR when it's convenient. I'll be your coffee cleaner upper when it's convenient. I mean, so just really, it's still a very selfish, self-centered, taking relationship with AA. My dad used to tell me all the time, you're such a taker. And I used to, like, get really upset about that, you know? I'm like, how can you call me a taker? Look what you've done to me. Anyway, you're a taker. But I didn't really understand. I really didn't understand. I didn't have a clue. I really didn't understand what he was saying to me because I could not see myself. All I saw was just my self-centered crap and what was being done to me. So I wasn't even aware of a lot of that. That's why strong sponsorship is so important. Clear, direct, strong sponsorship. We don't care what you think. We don't care how you feel. You just go do these things. It's so important for people like me. Clear-cut directions. You know, Camille used to say to me, you know, if I want your opinion, Valerie, I will give it to you. You don't have anything I want. You don't have anything to say here. She was very tough on me. And very direct, and I'm so grateful for that. And she had no problem getting in my face, and several times she was in my face yelling. But that was also at that time, it was the only way I could hear somebody. I couldn't hear you any other way. You almost had to scare me. But she got my attention. Anyway, so she just said, you know, if you're willing to change, and if you're willing to do these things, we'll start at the beginning of the book where it says write, we're going to write. Where it says pray, we're going to pray. Where it says go here and do this, we're going to go here and do this. And we're just going to follow these directions without leaving anything out. And we're going to do it together. And are you willing? And because I saw that hope, I said, yes, I am. And that's what really started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. That's where my life changed dramatically for me. My life hasn't been the same since. And that's the message that I carry to the women that I sponsor today and hopefully carry into the rooms of AA. Camille, I had her for a couple of years, and then I got this other guy, Don, who's dead now, and he sponsored me for about 7 or 8 years. And those two people really helped me tremendously. They helped me really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. They really helped me bring my experience to our literature that I really am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I don't think I really took a thorough first step until I was about when I started working with Camille. I mean, I knew I was an alcoholic and it wasn't a good idea that I drink, whatever, but that I'm absolutely doomed, that I have absolutely no control, power, or choice with that. I had not gotten that at depth. And that changed a lot of things for me in my pursuit of a spiritual life once I got that. I had a lot of help with the second step because I had some really funky ideas about God. Like Joe talked about, I remember calling Don up one time and I just was all in a tizzy about a problem. And I can't remember what it was, but I had such a rigid relationship with God. I was like, if I don't pray just right, if I don't say it just right, if I don't do this just right, I'm not going to get any relief. And I desperately want some relief. And Don said to me, well, what's your idea of God here? And I said, well, and I couldn't believe this came out of my mouth, but out comes God's vengeful and vindictive and punishing. God plays effing favorites, and I'm not going to, it's not going to happen for me. And he said, well, you've got God set up as a version of you. And because I am all those things, I am punishing, I am vindictive, I do withhold, I play favorites. But stuff like that. So I started to examine my ideas, like our literature talks about, my prejudices, my old ideas, the things that are getting in the way of me having a relationship with a God in my understanding, and started uncovering those things slowly. You know, I really believe that there are the haves and have-nots, that God had favorites. And I was perpetually going to be a have-not. Because I really struggled with the spiritual life. It seemed like people seemed to be getting it and getting this relationship with God, and I wasn't getting it. I mean, I used to hate it when people would say to me, oh, no matter what, I'm going to be okay. Valerie, it's going to be okay. I thought they were full of crap. I didn't understand what they were talking about. I could not let go within. I could not grasp that. I understood it here, but I didn't understand it here. And I remember exactly where I was, exactly what was going on, the situation that was happening when that changed for me. I remember exactly where I was, where that internal thing changed. And I began to really have some serious faith that really I can trust this. It's, you know, it's not crazy anymore. I've been through the steps. It's a little bit sane. I can trust my gut. I've been ignoring my gut for years. Years. I didn't listen to that small, quiet voice inside that always turned out to be right. I didn't listen to that. And I remember when I made a conscious decision to trust that, and everything worked out okay. And that's how it's been ever since for me. So today I know that everything's going to be okay no matter what. No matter what comes down the pike. And a lot of stuff has come through. But anyway, they really helped me examine my beliefs with God. And they helped me really do a thorough third step, turn my will and my life over. They really got me into action with the fourth step and immediately doing that. And my first four step that way, writing it out of the book, was pretty big. I had never written fourth column inventory before. And I had an amazing experience with that. And I remember when I was reading some of it to Don, him saying to me, I was like, oh, this is my part. And he said, really? Where in the big book does it say my part? And I'm like, well, it's in there. He goes, go find it for me. I hate when they do that. Because then you know you're screwed. And when they say, you know, show me. So I go looking for it, and it's not in there. And he said, it doesn't say my part. This is just about you now. This is about where you were wrong. You know, and these are resentments that you can't get free of because you still think that other person has another part. Every time you say my part, they still got a part, and we totally set them aside. This isn't about them anymore. We're resolutely looking for your own mistakes in your actions and in your thinking. And once I got that, I really started to get free. And a lot of things that were in my inventory that I never thought that I would get free of, that there was no way that I was at fault or to blame and blah, 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 I started to get free of and really start to see the truth about. You know, how I like to play the victim. How I like to keep people off balance. How I can't be trusted. Why I didn't trust anybody is because I was completely untrustworthy. I mean, things like that. Truths that I hadn't been able to see before about myself. And I also started to experience a tremendous amount of forgiveness once I started writing fourth column. Because I just started to see my own faults. And it truly became about where I was wrong. And it really wasn't about them anymore. And I can't do that on my own. On my own, you will always be more wrong than me. Always. It will always be your fault. You know, not too long ago, and I still can't believe that this was going on, but if I woke up in a bad mood, it was my husband's fault. And I've just reckoned, that thing has been going on for a while, but I've just recognized that that's wrong. That's faulty thinking. You know what I mean? But really believing that it's his fault that I'm not happy right now. I mean, that's crazy. So anyway, so still a lot to learn, a lot of room for growth here. So anyway, they just got me active in that. And now it's a regular part of my life. You know, it's not a big deal to me today to, if I get a resentment, to just write it out and read that to someone and ask God to remove it and get on about the business of helping other alcoholics in the business of living. Just these steps have just become principles that have just become a part of my life and my way of life. They're not on the wall anymore to me. They're not so rigid to me anymore. It's just become a way of life. So anyway, I you know, with my first big inventory, I did a fifth step. I drove out to Louisville, Kentucky. Randy was with me. Got speeding tickets on the way. That's another way you can tell if your life is unmanageable. I was getting so many speeding tickets in sobriety. Couldn't pay my bills. Nothing. Couldn't manage money for nothing. I mean, my driver's license was like negative 22 or something like that. I was on the verge of losing it completely. Sober. You know, but I'm in a hurry. You know, I had to get there. You know, always on the edge. Very, never present. Always late. You know, I hated it when my sponsor said to me, you're so self-centered, show up on time. What do you think? Your time is more important than mine. I mean, just low blows like that. You just hate it. You know, that just flatten you. Anyway, but I went out to Louisville, Kentucky. She sat me in a room. I didn't get to read it to her first. I had to read it to somebody else. And then she sent somebody else in. You know, I didn't know these people from Adam. And Our literature talks about that. We can read our inventory to person or persons. And for me, even though I hated it at the time, it was the best experience for me because I was such a liar. And I was such a, this is what I want you to see, but the reality and the truth about my life is something completely different. There's nothing transparent in my life whatsoever. I was the actor. This is what I want you to see, and I'll lie to you so I can impress you in the process, or whatever. I'll tell you what you want to hear. I'll do what you want me to do while you're looking. All that kind of stuff. I was such a liar. It was really good for me to read that to more than one person because all of that just got smashed. And I also realized that I'm not different. And I really thought in a lot of ways I was still different from y'all. And I realized that I'm not different from sharing that. You know, because I used to, when I'd write inventory, I used to want to edit it. Because I didn't want you to see how bad I was. Because I didn't think that you thought that way or you did the same things that I did. I really thought that I was sicker than you. That I was worse off than you. And I've really come to find out that I'm not any different than any other alcoholic. Circumstances might be a little bit different, but same kind of thinking, same kind of feeling, some kind of fear. I mean, just craziness. So I found out that I wasn't different. When did 6 and 7, it's always been extremely pivotal for me. I've had several, it doesn't happen every time, but there have been several times in sobriety where I've had really pivotal, amazing spiritual experiences with 6 and 7. I do exactly what it asked me to do in the book. I spend the hour. I really go into prayer. There have been times where I've written inventory and I can see that stuff is objectionable, but I just don't want to let it go, my character defects, because I still think they're of use to me. One of my favorite ones is lying. I love to lie, and I like to reserve the right to lie, because I may need it if I get into trouble or do something stupid. So I still have held on to that, you know. And, I mean, dishonesty, unfortunately, still shows up on my inventory on a regular basis. Well, I'm not telling you the whole truth. Anyway, so, but just stuff like that. When I go into 6 and 7, I try to go as surrendered as possible, as willing as possible, to have God remove the things which are standing in the way of me doing what God would have me do. You know, being of service to other people. And God's changed me. I mean, I haven't stolen anything in a long time. I don't lie on a really regular basis. I still do sometimes, but I don't lie all the time. I'm not stealing from you. I'm not trying to steal your time anymore. I'm not trying to steal your experience from you anymore. I'm not looking for you to fix me anymore. On the whole, you know, God's changed me. A lot of things that I was capable of doing, I'm no longer capable of doing. And that's just a result of doing the steps up to that point and asking God to remove it and then going out and making amends. I owed a lot of money when I got to amends. I didn't want to pay that money back. It was mine, and I was barely making any money at that time anyway. I think I owed God $40,000-$50,000, and I was making $12,500 a year. It was inconceivable to me to pay that money back. Inconceivable. And I was just told, you took it out of the world, you got to put it back into the world. You pick one, I don't care which one it is, and you start making payments. If it's $1, $5 a month, and you just start. And it was very difficult for me to write that check. It was one of the hardest things in the world for me to do because I had a weird relationship. I had a very sick relationship with money. I wasn't spiritually fit in the finance department. And anyway, but that, the more I started to pay that back, the more money started to come into my life. I don't know why that happens, but that's been my experience. The money would always show up for me to make those amends and to start paying off all the money that I owed to creditors and to people. I've done a nice little job, though, of running myself into debt this time, but I'm paying that back, and it's not from stealing. So it's good. It's progress. You know? So anyway. So I'm paying off a little debt now. I've talked to some other alcoholics who, you know, they get free of all that stuff and they stay free for a while with their finances and then they just go right back into the crapper. So that's where I'm at, crapper. Slowly crawling myself out. Anyway, so making amends and getting into with my family, making amends to them, to my ex-husband, and staying current when I cause damage today, to go back and make amends quickly. For a long time, it felt like I was constantly making amends every time I turned around. It felt like I was writing inventory every time I turned around. It's not so much like that anymore. I've calmed down a little bit and just gotten a little bit weller, I guess, where that's not going on all the time. But amends have been a powerful experience for me, just doing them, because there were a lot that I wasn't willing to do, and just becoming willing has changed me dramatically to just go do that stuff and to trust our literature. I heard somebody say once, I think it's so true, you know, that if sleeping with newcomers in the first 6 months worked, that would have been in the big book, but it's not, so it didn't work. But the stuff that's in there does work, so let's just do it and do it together, and everything will be okay. Because there were a lot of amends I was just terrified to go make, because I was afraid I was going to go to jail. I was afraid I was going to lose something or I was going to get something, and that hasn't been my experience at all. It's been very freeing, and just amazing, and on so many levels. I believe in being active in a prayer life, and in carrying this message to other alcoholics. I'm very active in my home group, very active in sponsoring others and in trying to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, that comes from very strong sponsorship. To me today, I know I'm at my best when I'm helping another alcoholic. No question. That's when I'm at my best. And when things are going on in my life, when life comes to visit, which it does, the best thing that I can do is go help another alcoholic. You know, instead of getting into navel gazing or, you know, trying to, for a period there, I was using the steps trying to manage my life and starting to using the steps to try to manage my spiritual life. And what I've come to find out is that the spiritual life is none of my business either. That I can't even manage that. That God reveals God's self to me on God's timetable, not mine. And I mean, it happens in the most unexpected ways and in the most unexpected places, and things within me change without me, you know, asking for it or directing it in any way. It just shows up. So I can't even manage that. So the best thing I can do is just show up and be of service in every area of my life, and be transparent in every area of my life. You know, so I'm the same at home as I am at work, as I am in AA, as I am with my friends, as I am with my family. You know, carry this stuff into all my affairs. And because of the example that's been set to me, that's what I've been able to do today to the best of my ability. And thanks so much for letting me be here.
Thank you, Jesse.